I'd like to invite Christian Teal to come up and have our opening prayer for us. Let's kneel as he's coming up.
Bow your heads with me. Dear Father, please be with us as we go through this day. And as we start this morning, I ask that our hearts and minds would be opened, that you would impart to us knowledge, and that we would be able to understand and know you better. Please, Lord, enter our hearts this day. Fill us with your Holy Spirit, and may we do your work. Amen.
Good morning, young disciples.
Good morning, sir.
This morning, we're looking at one of the most beautiful ideas in the entire Bible. But first, let me come to your homework so I don't end up skipping it. Who found something yesterday that you would be interested in sharing? And if you shared yesterday, just don't raise your hand. Go ahead. What did you find? Is that Miss Olivia? Speak loud. Uh-huh. And what did you think about that verse, Olivia? Did it have a special thought to you, or just that it's related to the topic?
I thought that we shouldn't
fear because so God will put us in his own steps. He's gone before us. We can follow him. That sounds like a shepherd and sheep, doesn't it? And that way you end up doing what he does. Very good. Someone else right here found something yesterday. In your yes, go ahead, Mr. Luke.
Yeah, this was from Seeking the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
In Psalm 47, verse 8. When thou said, seek ye my face, my heart said unto thee, thy face, Lord, will
I be. I got the idea in that verse, like I heard from Deja Usher this morning in the sharing time. I heard the idea that when you look in the Bible for seeking the Lord, a lot of what you find are promises. Have you noticed that? That mostly what you find are promises? And the promises are that if you seek him, you will find him. In other words, the Bible never paints a picture of someone seeking the Lord with all their might and not being able to find him. That's not the picture. The picture is rather of people who just neglect their opportunities. But those who will seek him will find him. Did someone else find something before we go on to our study this morning? Miss Ellie.
I was found 23. Thank you.
And I want to just bounce off that or launch from there, would be a better word, into this idea of substitution. I hope this is okay to erase, but regardless, it's about to be erased. Substitution is an idea that has a lot to do with fanaticism. Now, I'm not going to ask you who, but does anyone here think they know a fanatic? Maybe you think you know a fanatic? And it looks like more boys know fanatics than girls, or maybe, but it looks like that some of you know a fanatic. And I told you I'm not going to ask you who, right? I just want to show you this morning something you'll find about righteousness. Turn to Romans chapter 10. Romans chapter 10 talks about the idea of righteousness as it relates to our memory passage. Remember, in our memory passage, righteousness is, we receive a gift of righteousness. Romans chapter 10, let's turn there. Talking about fanaticism. You don't really find the word fanaticism in the Bible, you just find the idea. Are you in Romans 10? Let's look at verse 1. Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. Was Paul a Jew? He was a Jew. And he was a Roman citizen that was a Jew. You know, so he had a nation and he had a race. That's a lot. Like a lot of people, you ask them if you're really immature, you might think that an American is both a nation and a race. But can you be an American and be any race? You can. And in the same way, you could be a Roman and be any race. Paul was a Roman, and what was his race? He was a Jew. And he had a burden to save the Jews. Now, I have a friend who's a Jew, and she's a Seventh-day Adventist. And she was giving Bible studies 2 weeks ago to an Orthodox Jew. Orthodox Jews don't usually take Bible studies, so that's pretty special. And she wrote back to me a little perplexed because the Orthodox Jew believes that the Bible has about 600 commandments. Not 10, but about 600, a little over 600. And he challenged her to show why we exalt the 10 and say that they're different than the other, well, it's about 613, so the other 600. Why do we put the 10 above? Does anyone have any idea what's special about the 10? Why we might separate them from the rest of the commands? What's one idea? Why might we? So those are the only ones he wrote in stone, right? Those are the only ones. Yes.
It specifies God's character.
Okay. Maybe everything God says describes his character, but here is a real succinct description, the Ten Commandments, that show what his character is like in a moral sense. You have an idea why we separate them? Okay, in fact, he even said he added no more, which is just the idea you're sharing. So yeah, in fact, if you look up the word 10 in your Bible in a concordance, you'll find that God twice uses this word, 10 commandments. He's the one who said 10. That wasn't like a Seventh-day Adventist that said 10. It wasn't an Orthodox Jew that said 10. Who said 10? God said 10. And he had them put right inside the ark. And the ark was called the Ark of the Covenant. So you have an idea, it's just pretty simple right there, that of what was going on. But then something happened on Facebook this week related to what we're going to read in Romans 10. Someone on Facebook advocated that we ought to be keeping the feast days. Now maybe you keep the feast days, and there's nothing wrong with keeping the feast days, but this person was advocating that we must do it. And so I tried to very politely add a thought right there saying if you want to see an alternative view or another way of looking at these verses, and I referred them to an article that I'd written about this at my own website. I put it there. And then someone who I don't know, I shouldn't even tell you his name because I'm going to say something about him, but I don't know him, but he wrote the most interesting comment. He, speaking of me, he said, Eugene Pruitt, your Facebook picture shows that you don't have any respect for the commandments of God. Now, my Facebook picture has a beautiful woman in it, and I'm standing right behind her. And, you know, it's just my wife and I. That's all that's in the picture, and it's not even the whole of us. It's just, you know, from like here to here. Except for when they make the little small version, it's about to hear. You know how that happens on Facebook sometimes? And but that's it. What is it about my picture that showed that I don't respect the commands of God? Well, I found out. It was my facial hair. This man believes that it's wrong to trim the corners of your beard. And sure enough, his picture shows his belief. And you can tell that he has not made that distinction between the 10 and the rest. And that causes some confusion when you don't understand the significance of the 10. Are you still in Romans 10? Romans 10, verse 2. For I bear them record, them would be the Jews, the Hebrews. For I bear them record that they have a zeal of God, but not according to, what's it say? Can you be zealous and not be very knowledgeable? Indeed, it's very common. In fact, some of the most zealous people are not knowledgeable. Even some people who die as martyrs for the Quran can hardly read. Some of them, you don't have to be very knowledgeable to be zealous. People can get very excited over a very small amount of knowledge. And frequently, I've seen people, especially in the realm of health, go off on a tangent just after three or four pages of documentation, and it becomes almost like the ninth natural doctor, some little new idea that they have. Verse 2 talks about a zeal not according to what? Knowledge. I would encourage you to get excited about things, but be sure you know what you're getting excited about. Be sure. Look at verse 3. For they, being ignorant of, what does it say? God's righteousness. That's what we're trying to understand this morning, is whose righteousness? And here are some people that were very zealous for righteousness, but they're ignorant of whose righteousness? The Jews didn't understand God's righteousness. And because of that, it says they're going about to establish what? Now, what an interesting idea. So here's a Jewish man, and he fasts for 2 days every week. And he pays tithe not only on his money, but on the different things that grow in his garden and on every little thing that comes to him. And he, I'm trying to remember what else he said he does. Fast twice in a week, pay tithe of all that I possess. Maybe that's all he said. I don't remember. And I'm sure he does other things. Like, he probably has little scrolls that he ties to his clothes and probably has some other little parchments that he keeps on him somewhere. And probably by his door there are little written things. And he's trying to do everything just right. He doesn't walk too far on the Sabbath, and he won't light a match. There were no matches back then. But he won't start a fire on the Sabbath, and he tries to do everything just right. The Bible describes him as trying to be righteous, but whose righteousness is he trying to establish? His own. He's trying to do everything just right, and he's zealous. He's really zealous to do his own righteousness, to get it up to snuff, you know, to get it to be enough. That almost rhymed. It did rhyme, snuff and enough. And he wants to have his own righteousness and get it all the way up there. But he's ignorant about something. What's he ignorant of in the verse? God's righteousness. I'll tell you, if he knew about God's righteousness, it would change everything for him. Let's keep reading verse 3. Going about to establish their own righteousness, they have not, what's the verb there? Submitted themselves unto what? It looks like that the way you get your own righteousness is by doing your own righteousness. But the way that you get to God's righteousness is you submit. That's quite interesting. How do you get to God's righteousness in verse 3? You submit. Suppose that you submit. Is your submission the righteousness? That's a tricky question, but you all seem to get the right answer, even though it was tricky. No, submission is not the righteousness. Submission is how you get the righteousness. And the righteousness isn't yours. You're in Romans. Maybe a good place to go here would be back to chapter 4. We're doing deep Bible study about the idea of God's righteousness. Romans chapter 4 and looking at verse 5. Now we need to go all the way back to verse 4. Romans 4, verse 4. Now to him that worketh is the reward not reckoned of grace, but of debt. How many of you here have had a job this summer where you earn money? I see the hands of those who earned money this summer. And it looks, let's most of you have earned money. Which way was it? You worked and then asked someone to pay you for it, or someone asked you to work and told you how much they were going to pay you? If you just do the work volunteer and then ask for money for it, that's a little bit manipulative. Now, sometimes it works out that you just volunteer to do a job and someone just out of their kindness pays you for it, but then you're not really expecting it. You get happily surprised when that happens, right? But typically, when you work, What happens is someone says, would you mow my lawn? I'll give you $10. And you, or five or two or whatever the case may be. If you're in the right neighborhood in California, maybe 20. So someone asks you to mow the lawn and you agree to do it and then they pay you. When they pay you for mowing the lawn, did they owe you the money or were they just being kind? You made an arrangement, right? The arrangement you made is that you work and they owe you the money. Now, we can get that confused sometimes because I remember when I was as old as about the third, like probably the row that has Paul Schaefer in it. Paul, how old are you? Yes, I was exactly your age when this story happened, but you probably have more sense than I did at that point. I knew that my cousins were getting paid for working for their dad. He was a contractor. He built houses. He had them working with him from the time they were like 11 and 12. These guys could put up walls and do flooring and put the roof on and do finish work. They really knew their stuff. And he paid them good money because they were doing hard work just like the adults on the job. And I envied that because I didn't get money, you know, and they got money. And so I went to live with him for a short time just before academy because he lived closer to my academy. And I thought, now I'll get to go work and he'll pay me. But can you think of a reason why he might not want to pay me as much as his own boys? What would be one reason? I don't know what I'm doing. Plus, maybe I'm not as hardworking. So there might be a combination of reasons why he might not owe me equally like he pays his own boys, right? So he didn't even offer to take me out on the job. But his wife asked me to mow the lawn. And they were feeding me, by the way, at that house. And I mowed the lawn, and I thought, now they're going to pay me. But you know, they weren't intending to pay me. You know why? They were feeding me. They didn't owe me any food. They figured if you're living there, you ought to do something for your own keep, right? I mean, to help cover your own expenses. And I felt kind of bad about that. And they could tell I felt bad about the fact that they weren't going to pay me for mowing the lawn. So the next day, my uncle agreed to take me out into the workplace. And I think he knew what to do. He gave me the job of putting insulation in the walls. And it doesn't require a lot of knowledge, just a lot of work, right? And I would actually earn my keep. I think that's what he was thinking. And so I did the work, and he paid me. I'm trying to illustrate something by the silly story. And that is, there is an idea of work where you work to earn a living, or you work for money, or you work for wages. Then there's another type of work altogether. That's like where you see that your mother's really stressed and has too much to do, and she's cooking in the kitchen on Friday morning, and you say, Mom, can I help you? And you help her for an hour, and then do you expect, ladies, after you do that she's going to give you money? That would just be ridiculous, right? You're helping her because she needs help, and you feel good doing it. You actually feel like you were a good girl when you do it. Guys, you might even feel like a good boy if you did it. You wouldn't feel like a good girl for sure. Do you see that that's a different type of work? This is a work you do for wages, and that's a work you do for love. And this distinction is one being brought out here. Verse 4 says, now him that works is the reward not reckoned of grace, but of debt. Which kind of work is that? Isn't that the work for wages? But to him that works not, but believes on him that justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted for righteousness. There's a lot of big words there, but let me try to make it understandable for the 11-year-olds. In verse 5, to be justified means to be forgiven. And in verse 5, who gets forgiven? Is it good people or ungodly people? In verse 5, ungodly people are forgiven. That ought to be good news. You ought to be very happy about that, because if you know yourself, you know that that might describe you. So ungodly people are forgiven in verse 5. And are they forgiven because they earned their forgiveness or because they believed? It's very clear that forgiveness is not based on work. Forgiveness is not a wage. It's not that you work, 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 and so God says, Yep, you've worked enough. I now owe you forgiveness. It's not like that. People who think like that are like the Jews that we read about in Romans 10. They're going about to establish whose righteousness? Their own. So it's like me trying to mow the lawn for my aunt. You know, I'm mowing the lawn and I'm thinking I'm establishing my income. I'm establishing my income. But the thing is, does my aunt owe me anything? And you know, when you work really hard to live a righteous life, God doesn't owe you anything. He doesn't. Because what? How much do you owe God? Your life. You owe him your life. He made you, for example, so you're not your own. So you owe him your own. So this is really, there's good news in it, but we haven't got to the good news yet. I'm just going to describe the bad news. The bad news is I'm hopelessly in debt to God. Hopelessly. I mean, how can I illustrate hopeless debt? The only thing that comes to my mind is the American national deficit, but that might be hard to understand. So I'm trying to find a smaller picture of hopeless debt. I can give you a picture that happens sadly in the world. There are people in the world who are farmers, small-scale farmers, that they can't afford seed. And so one of the world's large evil seed companies comes to them and says, "Don't worry, we'll give you seed on consignment. That is, we'll give you seed for free and you pay for it when you sell your produce." And so the farmers are so happy because they can afford seed now, right? And when are they going to pay for it? When they sell their stuff. So they take the seed, they grow their stuff, and they give their stuff to that company to sell. And then the company comes back and says, "We're sorry, but your stuff rotted before we could sell it. So there's not, so you still owe us for the seed. But don't worry, we'll give you more seed to do that again this year." And that some companies that have done this were just lied to the farmers. And what they're really doing is they're creating slaves. Because pretty soon the farmer, after 3 or 4 years, there's no way he'll ever be able to pay the debt for the seeds. So all his life he's just going to have to work for that same company. And he'll just barely get enough to survive. And they've just made a slave out of him. Isn't that evil? It's a hopeless debt that poor farmer has. There's no way to get out of it. God could have left us like that because we owed him our whole life. And when you owe God your whole life, it's like when your dad loans you a car and you owe it to him to protect the whole car. If you only crash the front left bumper, is he going to be content if you give him the rest of the car back? Really, what you owed him back was the whole car. And just one bumper part is enough to put you in debt. And if you earn $1 a week as your allowance, it's going to take a long time to pay for that bumper at that rate. I'm trying to find lots of ways to illustrate an idea about God's righteousness. I can't earn it because I already sinned in my life. And no matter how much I obey from now on, I might be able to deliver one half of a good car, but if the first half of the car is already messed up, the fact that the other half of the car is just fine is just not going to be satisfactory. There's no way. So what God has done is he has made a substitute. I love the word substitute when it comes to the gospel. It's one of my favorite words. The idea that Jesus came to earth, and did Jesus owe the Father anything? He did not. The Father didn't create Jesus. So Jesus had his own life, unborrowed. It was like you could say his own car, or you could say it was his own life. It belonged to him all by himself, so he didn't owe the Father anything. And when he lived a life of righteousness, excuse me, when Jesus lived a life of righteousness, did I not wash my hands after breakfast? He is going to distract everyone, so I think maybe I will see if I can get him to go away. That might not work. If Jesus didn't owe the Father anything and he lived a whole life from beginning to end and it was perfect, then Jesus is not in debt to the Father. In fact, if he didn't owe him anything, he was doing that work, you could say, for wages. And now the Father is going to pay Jesus for living a righteous life during a time of temptation and trial and difficulty. I mean, Jesus lived a perfect life under pressure to do wrong. Isn't that true? It was hard work, and Jesus did it. He worked for 30 years, and then he bore terrible pressure. He earned a lot of righteousness. Can you earn righteousness like that? You can't, because you owe God your life. But Jesus earned it. And what Jesus did then after earning that beautiful righteousness is he took my sin, he took your sin, and he carried it himself. He suffered in our place, and he paid the debt for our sin. Thank God it wasn't just the sins I've done in the past. He also paid the debt for the sins I will do in the future. He paid the whole debt. So when my name comes up in the judgment, you understand about the judgment? Have you ever learned about the judgment? The judgment is going on right now, and let me explain it to you in case it's never been explained well. In the judgment, my name will come up. I don't think it has come up yet, so I think it's still future. And Eugene Pruitt's name will be right there. And watching will be about 100 million angels. That's what it says in the book of Daniel. And then helping out will be about 1 million angels that are gathering records, not just for me, maybe just one for me, but that they're working and gathering records and taking care of the record keeping for everyone on planet Earth. About 100 million are watching, about 1 million are helping out. And Jesus will come to my name, and this is what I'm expecting to happen. This is what I'm depending on. My whole life is built on this hope, that Jesus will look at the records and say, look, every angel, and do you see that Eugene has been living by faith? Eugene has been depending on the power of my word. He has been showing the kind of characteristic that allows me to change a heart. He has submitted to my requirements, and I'm going to cover his entire life with my righteousness. That is, Jesus pleads his blood to pay for my sins. And what happens is, it's not that he just covers a little bit of my life. He covers the whole thing. I get a robe of righteousness that is not even my own life. It's his life. It's pure. It's 100% righteous. And it counts for me. That's substitution. Then something special happens. Since I have a whole life just covered, that's my forgiveness. That's my title to heaven. Then we come to the record about my life, because the record of my life doesn't look like that. It has a mixture of good things and bad things. And you know, the bad things are going to be blotted out. Every one of them completely erased. So what's left? It's good things. Now, what righteousness do I have over here? It's the righteousness of Christ, and that's what covers my whole life. So it's as if my whole, what I owe to God is all covered. Oh, phew, it's this. You know, I felt this and thought it was a yellow jacket. And it was, anyway, it wasn't. Christ's life covers my whole life, and that means that my good deeds now are extra. They're on top of what I owe. How can they be extra? Well, what paid for my whole life? Jesus paid for my whole life, and that's why we get rewarded for our good deeds. I don't know. I don't think I left you in Romans 10, but let me tell you what you saw there, and then we'll go on to another idea. What you saw in Romans 10 is that some people have a zeal, and I think you've met them because you said you've met some fanatics. Some people have a zeal for whose righteousness? They're trying to establish their own. They have not submitted to the righteousness of God. And because of that, they make all kinds of, Ellen White calls these false tests. That is, new tests. And instead of the question being, are you obeying the commands of God and living by the faith of Jesus? That's the test that is in Revelation 14. The test might be, do you believe in that a certain prophecy really was real? Or do you believe that ladies must never, ever cut their hair? Or that men mustn't trim their beards? Or do you believe, I just can make a lot of examples, but I don't know how many people, their toes I would stand on in making all my examples. They make another test. They say that this is the thing that will divide the sheep and the goats. But none of these things will divide the sheep and the goats. What divides the sheep and the goats is a faith that works by love and purifies the soul. I said the same thing 20 times. Look at James chapter 1. James chapter 1. We should go to verse 19 because that's the first half of the sentence. James 1. I heard someone asking where James is. It's about three quarters of the way through the New Testament. It's after all the T's. It's around the Peters and it's before the Johns. Not all the Johns, just the three that are together. James chapter 1, verse 19. Did you find it? Are you volunteering to read it to us? You were just saying you found it. Okay, verse 19 says, wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man, what do you think, ladies? Does this be gender inclusive or gender exclusive? Inclusive means it would account for ladies too. That's what that phrase means. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Now, I take a verse like that and I think it through and see if you can think it through with me. Think back to the last time you were angry. Can you see a connection between your anger and the fact that you reacted too quickly to what was going on? That how being fast to speak is related to being fast to wrath? When I look back, I can see a connection like that. I can see that just waiting a bit to calm down before I say anything makes it easier to control a temper. And then the first part said, be swift to hear. And I have so noticed that people don't always listen very well. In fact, when I'm canvassing, some of you, a lot of you have canvassed with me here, and a lot of you are going to be doing it today. I learned something when I was your age that lowered my opinion of humanity. I noticed that I could say to someone that I leave this book for a donation. Most people are giving about $10 for it. And that person would say something like, we don't have any money. We're not interested. And I could say, okay, that's fine. They gave us a sample and show another one. They said to leave that one for a donation. Most people are giving about $10 for it. And they'd say, okay, and they'd give me $10. The same person who said that they didn't have any money when I said it cost $10, 40 seconds later whips out $10 and buys the book. And they don't look embarrassed or ashamed like you caught me. I watch this on scores of faces. They're completely oblivious to how they've just contradicted themselves. There's nothing on the face to register that they realize that they just made themselves look a little foolish. You know why it doesn't register? Because they weren't listening the first time. Many people, when you're at their door and you start with the "Hi, my name is," they're just thinking about how to get rid of you. They don't hear what you're saying. They're just thinking. They come up with an idea. I know. I'll say I don't have any. So while you're saying it's $10, they're just waiting for a pause, and you sort of pause after that, and it's their chance. They say, I don't have any money. And you go, okay, that's fine. And they go, got it. And then you tell them that you have a book for a donation just for $10. You think, oh, that's nothing. And it's because they're not listening. And when what I'm trying to explain to you by that illustration is maybe you don't listen very well either. It takes a real challenge to listen when there's something you want to say. Now look at the next verse, because we're trying to study the righteousness of God. The next verse says, for the wrath of man, what's it say? That's what I deserved. I asked you what it said, and you read me the whole verse. That's right. The wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. There's an idea that some parents need to learn. And some of you are going to be parents. Probably a lot of you are going to be parents. When you're a parent, I hope you're going to remember that when you get ticked off, that you're not working the what? You're not. And when someone who's really angry and tries to, and because of his anger, he punishes, even if a teacher, some of you want to be teachers, a teacher that gets angry like that, is he working the righteousness of God? The wrath of man doesn't. The wrath of man is very natural. Whatever the righteousness of God is, it must involve a power from outside and above me. And that's the idea you find when you study the righteousness of God. Let's look at one more verse on this and then change gears for a couple minutes. Look at Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2. We're studying the idea of the righteousness of God. Because in our memory passage, those that seek his face, they receive, those that have clean hands and a pure heart, what do they receive? Righteousness from God, right? Are you in Romans 2?
Yes, sir.
Romans 2, we're going to look at verse 13. For not the hearers of the law are just before God. Just there means like forgiven. It doesn't mean like very close. For not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be
justified.
Well, look at that verse and think it through. Which comes first in that verse? You do the law or you're justified? In that verse, which comes first? In that verse, you do the law, and what comes next is you are justified. It's the same idea that's everywhere else in Romans. It's righteousness by faith. That is, when you live by faith, you can't earn your own righteousness living by faith. But what you can do is you can meet the condition that God has given to be covered with the perfect righteousness of Jesus. Camp must be a wonderful place because some of you are getting really tired. And it must mean that yesterday you had plenty of fun. So I want you to stand up for just a few seconds. Stand up. Now have a seat. And, yep, you're better off for the last few minutes. I want you to think back. We're changing pages a little bit now. It's almost a story. Just the word story wakes people up. Even if it's not a story, it does. So you can use the word story as a teaching device. A long time ago, more than 6,000 years ago, in heaven, when Lucifer had just begun to sin and probably didn't even know what the word for sin, it was just beginning. He was just doing the wrong thing and beginning to share his perverse ideas with angels. Imagine that you're an angel, and Lucifer shares his perverse idea with you. Let's say that Lucifer's idea is there's a better way than the way that God said. There's a better way. Suppose that you're the angel, and you know you're going to have to go either Lucifer's way or God's way. You're going to have to choose. Go ahead and tell me, raise your hand if you have an idea. How could you know who's telling the truth? Do you have an idea how you would know?
Because God said that God's way is the right way.
Okay, so you're saying God's telling the truth because God tells the truth. Do you have an idea how you would know?
Yeah, God is the Almighty Master. God's
in. Okay, so God is in charge and he's the one who's powerful, so maybe that's why he's telling the truth. How would you know?
By knowing his true character.
Okay, so you might observe his character. Now, I think that we're getting closer to a right answer with that one, but before I take more hands, just think that through for a minute. Does Lucifer look like he has a good character or a bad character at this point? It looks like he has a pretty good one, but I still think you're on the right target with the idea of character. Yeah, what do you think? How would you know? Okay, so you could get some idea that God is wiser at least, right? Because he's the one who created. How would you know? Okay, trust would have a lot to do with this, right? And so let me take your idea. I forgot your name. I don't have really great eyes either. What does it say? Adriana. So Adriana said you'd have to trust him. I think, Adriana, this is part of the right answer. Because there's no way to know for certain that God's way is right except to experiment. And that's not very safe. Right?
No.
I mean, experiment would be like to try the other thing, because you've already been trying God's way for your whole life. You know how that goes, but what about the other way, the what he says is the better way? An experiment's really dangerous. So before I take you again, Adriana, I want to ask, does anyone have any ideas? Well, you've given me some, but you want to say something else. Go ahead. Maybe it's on target. Okay, so I don't know if they heard you, so I'm going to say it out loud what you said to me. He loves you. It's talking about the Creator. And you can see in creation that he really made things to make you happy. I don't know what heaven's like, so I'm going to talk about earth. But he made the peacock feathers to be really beautiful. And he made my wife to be really beautiful. And he made, like, the hummingbirds to just be magnificent, some of them, how they look in the sunlight. He made mangoes, and I mean the ones that are really ripe that you find on trees somewhere else than in Walmart. He made them really good. And he made those ripe, soft, organic peaches to taste the way they do. And I can just see abundant evidence, because if blind chance was making this world, it would be just fine to have us all eating grass. Right? Blind chance would not have any interest in making life pleasant. Like orchestra music is an evidence that God cares. The fact that you can appreciate it, that you can participate in it, that there's abundant evidence. So go back to that angel. I really think the reason that angels are not excusable for going the wrong way is they had a lot of this kind of evidence. They had abundant evidence that God was wise and caring, that he had done everything for their good, that their best happiness came in following his commands, that the universe had been created around their best interest. They had lots of evidence. And there was no evidence over here. The only evidence over here was a challenge to prove it. It's just, you can't prove it. You can't prove it, as if that's evidence. That thing still happens today. Still, many people will end up in the lake of fire because they demanded proof. Well, there's nothing wrong with demanding good, solid evidence, but it's pretty dumb to demand proof. Let me back up a minute and explain what I mean by that. I mean, if there is proof, then it's great, and go ahead and use the proof you got. If you got proof, use your proof. But if there's no proof, and you have to make a decision, you ought to go with the weight of what? Evidence. You ought to go with the weight of evidence. That's the only rational thing to do. When you have the evidence, and you go with the best evidence, that's why I believe God, because I have lots of evidence. I have now experience, I've experienced miracles, I've seen the power of prophecy. I have so much evidence over here that when I am confronted with a confusing thing on this side, it just doesn't throw me off the wall. I trust God because I see the evidence. What I'm trying to do right now, we're talking about righteousness by faith. I'm trying to help you with faith, to understand that faith is not a leap in the dark. Have you ever heard anyone talking about faith as a leap in the dark? That's the way scientists talk about faith. The way they see faith is kind of like you do experiments and that gets you up to the cliff, and then there's no more experiments, so you don't know what's down there. It's pitch black. You hope that it's not very far. You hope it's a lot of fun, and you just go for it. That's why many scientists do not want to be Christians. They think it's not smart. What do they think faith is? A leap in the dark. But what I'm trying to say to you is, no, faith isn't like that. Faith is more like when you come to this chasm, faith sees abundant evidence that God cares and that you ought to go with the evidence and step where the evidence is, and you can feel your way and even taste and see that the Lord is good. And that's going to work out. Where to go with the other way, you just don't even have any good evidence. And yeah, my faith is not a leap in the dark. It's depending on, I took 4 minutes to say that when I planned to take three. Righteousness is by faith. Amen. I didn't give you an assignment, so I'm going to give you one right now. And hopefully you're turned to Psalm 24. I'm just hoping that your class teachers will not make you do push-ups, because I can't do 10 for each of you. It would not work out no how. I can do about 17 and then I'm shot. We're looking at verse 7 and 8 tomorrow. And what I want you to study tomorrow is the word everlasting in the Bible. Find what kind of things or people are everlasting or eternal or anything like that. Study that word in the Bible. I think you'll be surprised what you find. Everlasting and eternal. Let's kneel for a prayer and we'll be done. Our Father in heaven, I thank you that you have left by your Son Jesus a robe of righteousness that is everlasting, one that we cannot mess up by any mistake that we make. I ask that you would teach us what it means to depend on you by faith, that we could be covered with that robe. I ask for your Spirit to go with us in the name of Jesus. Amen.